How do you date a myocardial infarction? The answer to this question is far from simple. The importance of addressing this question is that when the infarction is the result of acute coronary occlusion, the sooner reperfusion of the culprit artery can be accomplished, the more myocardium that can be saved, and the better the long-term prognosis. That said, realistically speaking, our ability to date an infarction from assessment of a single 12-lead ECG is far from perfect. Practically speaking, we are limited to classifying the ECG signs of infarction as being acute, subacute, old, or of uncertain age. My definitions for these terms are as follows. By acute, I mean an infarction that has just occurred, that is, within the past several hours or so, and or an infarction that is still actively ongoing. By subacute, I mean that the infarction is recent, albeit a bit older than occurring within the past few hours or so, perhaps a day or so ago, or 2 or even 3 days or so ago, which takes us to infarctions that are classified as old, by which we mean that the infarct is more than at least a couple of days old, be it a week old, a month old, or much longer ago than that. And finally, sometimes the best we can say is that an infarct is of uncertain age, which means that the infarction could be recent, perhaps even very recent, or that the infarction could be a good bit older than that, but with the caveat that by saying an infarction is of uncertain age, that we cannot rule out the possibility of a recent event, or even of an event that is still ongoing. Bottom line, in all too many cases, dating an infarct from the appearance of a single ECG is far from being an exact science, but instead offers no more than a rough approximation of when the infarct occurred. That said, what counts most clinically is trying to identify those infarctions that are acute or still in the process of actively evolving, because these are the infarctions that we can most positively impact on treatment, for which we have the best chance for improving clinical outcome by facilitating acute reperfusion of the acutely occluded artery. So, how do we start? We start with the question, when did the symptoms begin? There are times when the answer to this simple question gives us the answer. For example, a previously healthy adult who describes the abrupt onset of severe chest pain 1 hour before coming to the emergency department, with the patient having looked at his watch and therefore being certain of the time his symptoms started. If the initial ECG in the emergency department clearly shows acute changes, there would then be little doubt that the onset of this patient's event was acute, most probably corresponding to the onset of symptoms 1 hour earlier. Caveats. Many, if not most, patients do not present with this type of history. Instead, their recollection of the time of symptom onset is all too often far less precise, being uncertain about how many hours or longer ago it was that symptoms began. Adding to the difficulty of precisely dating an infarct is that there may be a stuttering course in which chest pain symptoms may come and go. Physiologically, what may be happening is that the culprit artery may acutely close, but then spontaneously open, and then close again, and then reopen again, sometimes spontaneously opening and closing multiple times over a short period of time. So even when you, as the clinician, are able to say when the overall process began, it will often not be possible to determine when the actual infarction with persistent coronary occlusion began. This is where serial ECGs come in. We are looking for dynamic ECG changes, especially when these correlate with what is going on with the patient. With acute coronary occlusion, there usually is chest pain, and this often correlates with acute ST elevation. If you catch the process early, you may see hyperacute ST segment and T-wave changes before there is actual ST elevation. When T-waves become hyperacute, they become hypervoluminous. By this I mean that T-waves become taller, fatter at their peak, and wider at their base than you expect them to be given the relative height of the R-wave in the lead you are looking at. It helps when you see these changes in at least 2 or more leads, especially if you see mirror image opposite reciprocal changes in other lead areas. Key concept. The more leads that show ST-T-wave abnormalities, the greater the chance that an acute process is evolving. I'll emphasize that changes may be subtle in a number of leads, but, for example, seeing hyperacute T-waves in 2 or 3 leads and then seeing additional ST-T-wave changes, even if subtle, in a number of other leads, is clearly cause for additional concern. Note, when the process is acute, ECG changes may evolve rapidly, sometimes over a matter of minutes. As a result, if in doubt, repeat the ECG often, sometimes with as little as 5 to 15 minutes between tracings if you suspect an acutely evolving process, because if you do truly see ECG changes in a number of leads that are not due to artifact or a wandering baseline or due to a shifting frontal plane axis or due to different lead placement in the chest leads, if you truly see dynamic ECG changes in one ECG compared to another done just a short while earlier in a patient with new chest pain, then you have virtually confirmed an acutely evolving process. Conversely, if the initial ECG on your patient is unremarkable and you do not see dynamic changes on repeated serial tracings, then while this does not completely rule out the possibility of ischemia, it does make it much less likely that acute reperfusion is immediately needed. Without going into detail here, I'll add that other aids for determining if there is an acute ongoing process in addition to serial ECGs include serial troponins, especially use of high-sensitivity troponins, and obtaining an echo at the bedside during chest pain, looking for a localized wall motion abnormality that corresponds to the area of concern on ECG. I'll emphasize that a normal echo obtained at a time when the patient is no longer having chest pain does not rule anything out. But if the echo is obtained during chest pain and is of good enough quality that you can be certain there is normal LV function, then you have essentially ruled out an acute cardiac event. I'll close with some final caveats. Caveat number one, if you are stuck on waiting for ST segment elevation before activating the cath lab, you will miss a significant percentage of patients with acute coronary occlusion that clearly can benefit from acute reperfusion. This is why I've emphasized the importance of serial ECGs looking for dynamic ST-T wave changes. Number two, be aware of the concept of reperfusion T waves. That is, following an acute STEMI, acute reperfusion, that is, reopening of the occluded artery, whether this reopening was obtained by angioplasty, thrombolytic therapy, or was a spontaneous reopening of the acutely occluded vessel, acute reperfusion will often be heralded by reduction, if not relief, of chest pain that occurs in association with resolution of ST elevation that then rapidly evolves into diffuse T-wave inversion. This diffuse T-wave inversion, seen in the area where previously there was ST elevation, constitutes what is known as reperfusion T-waves, and this is how you can tell if reocclusion of the culprit artery was to recur at some later point in time. Because if the culprit artery that has now reopened now closes again, then the patient will once again have chest pain that once again will occur in association with the return of ST elevation. Caveat number three. While true that seeing large Q waves in association with flat or normal ST segments suggests an old infarction, it should be appreciated that simply seeing large Q waves on ECG does not rule out the possibility of an acute event. This is because even large Q waves may sometimes develop in as little as 1 to 2 hours after the onset of infarction. The other possibility for explaining the presence of large Q waves with an acutely evolving process is that the patient may have had a prior infarction with residual Q waves and is now undergoing a reinfarction of the same anatomic area. Caveat number four, be aware of the transition phase during which ST segments and T waves may look unremarkable. By transition, what I mean is that if the initial ECG showed ST depression in multiple leads at a time when the patient was experiencing ischemia and a partially occluded vessel suddenly becomes completely occluded, those diffusely depressed ST segments on the initial ECG will return to the baseline on their way toward evolving into diffusely elevated ST segments. But if you happen to catch the patient during this time, in which the ECG was evolving from diffuse ST depression to diffuse ST elevation, it's possible that this transition phase ECG may look fairly normal. Considering the stuttering course that some patients with acute STEMI will evolve, in which the occluded culprit artery may spontaneously reopen and then occlude again, potentially repeating this process a number of times, this highlights the importance of correlating the timing of chest pain and its relative severity with each of the serial ECGs you obtain. Finally, I'll add that if the patient has multivessel disease, then all bets are off for predicting the distribution and appearance of ECG changes that you see because of potential opposing effects from ischemia in multiple anatomic areas and unpredictable patterns of collateral flow. Conclusion: you often will not be able to accurately date an infarction from a single ECG, but most of the time, you will be able to determine if the patient is likely to benefit from acute reperfusion therapy by ongoing evaluation, serial ECGs, troponins, and bedside echo if available.